from the King Arthur .com festival grounds.
This is another version of the story about Captain Samuel Davis, my great-grandfather, in a story called A Voice in the Night. The book it was taken from is called Tales Told Under the Old Town Clock by William Burrett, who was a station director at the radio station CHNS in Halifax, Nova Scotia. The book was published in 1942. A Voice in the Night, Superstition and Rescue at Sea. As we gather together again around the old town clock and gaze at the harbor, I am again thinking of the days of sail, of the days when the wharfs berthed those tall ships that are, alas, for the most part, no more. Engines have taken the place of sails, wide flung to catch the breeze. Steel plates have taken the place of Fundy spruce. Fortunately, the romance of sails remains. And through these weekly meetings of the old citadel, all the glamour of a day that is gone forever can still be ours. Some months ago, when it was my honor to have been serving with the Canadian Active Army, I met an old friend, Bert Robinson, who is also serving and whose unit is now overseas somewhere in England. He had joined up in Winnipeg, where he had been living for the last 5 or 6 years, and he was the only maritimer among the officers of this unit. So we naturally got into a corner and talked about many things. My friend was formerly a newspaper man and had written many stories along the lines of those I tell you each week. And so today, I'm going to tell you a yarn that he told me. And believe me, it's a corker. If you are superstitious, you'll be all ears. I think you'll listen anyway. A number of people wonder where I get my information every week. And well, the answer is from all sorts of places, from historical papers, from history books, from visiting many of the historic places in Nova Scotia, from talking to those who have made a study of things historical, and by picking up information here, there, and everywhere, and using my imagination and putting it in broadcast story form. Sometimes from direct information collected for me from which I make a story, sometimes people give me clues as to where to find a story, and sometimes from a friend like the story I will tell you today. Anyone who makes even the most careless study of these days of windships cannot fail to be very impressed by the superstitions that held sway both in the forecastle and in the after cabin. Some of these, like the tale of the Flying Dutchman, came down to modern days from the Middle Ages, but were so real to the old shellbacks that there are still men alive who tell of seeing the Dutchman ever beating south against a driving southeast gale around the Horn, but never making any headway. Two, it is a matter of record that many skippers refused to sail unless among the crew was numbered a Dane or a Finn, for these people were supposed to have supernatural power over the winds. Then, too, there was the kobold, a sprite who played the fiddle in the rigging of a ship that was doomed to be wrecked, and countless other superstitions. Old seamen will tell you of haunted ships without number, and a whole library could be written on the superstitions of the sea. It is more than possible that many of these superstitions had some basis in actual occurrence, for wonderful things happen at sea, just as they do on land. Today I want to tell you of a very remarkable happening, a happening that is still without any satisfactory explanation. Some, after hearing the story, will dismiss it with a shrug of the shoulders and say, coincidence. Others will see in it the power of an arm far mightier than that of the fickle goddess of chance. But here is the story. In 1872, the year that the Marquis of Dufferin became the Governor General of Canada, there was a bark launched in Quebec. In honor of the new Governor General's consort, the bark was named the Countess of Dufferin. Like most wooden ships, her story is almost unknown until the very end of her life. The last voyage of the Countess of Dufferin began from St. John in December 1891. Her captain was Captain Noble, and her cargo, deal and lumber. The Countess of Dufferin carried a very heavy deck load as well as the cargo in her hold. When she left St. John, it was with a following southwest breeze that kicked up the white caps and sped the bark on her way with every inch of canvas drawing. But as often the case, the fair weather did not last. The barometer began to fall rapidly until the mercury touched only the 28-inch mark. Every sign of the heavy blow hovered around the Countess of the Bufferin until, on Christmas Day, 1891, the gale began. It set in from the northward, almost the worst possible direction, for the seas were running from the south, and a gale from the north sent tremendous cross seas hurtling at the bark. Feeling none too safe with his heavy deckload of deal, which could not but help make the vessel top-heavy, Captain Doble, took every precaution that he could. He reduced sail to the main topsail, and as a further precaution, he set that goose-winged. He made a sea anchor and flung it overboard to keep the bark's head into the wind, and he cautioned his men to stand by in readiness to jettison the deckload of deal should necessity arise. But even these precautions were hardy enough. The gale swept down directly against the run of the sea, twisting and pounding the little bark until it seemed that she would never be able to stay afloat. Grimly, Captain Doble and his crew hung on with a series of disasters. They were stuck at the bark. First, a heavy sea swept from the Countess from astern and plunged into the forward cabin, completely ruining the supply of provisions which were kept there. Captain Doble ordered the men to get 2 barrels of apples which were in the stateroom, bring them on deck and make them fast. They got the apples, but before the barrels could be made fast, a tremendous sea swept them overboard. That was the last of the Countess of Dufferin's provisions. The next discovery, even more ghastly than the discovery of the loss of food, was that salt water had gone into the drinking water and made it quite unfit for use. Comment on this is needless. When the bark began to behave so badly that the deck load was jettisoned, even this, however, did not make the decks of the Countess safe for the men at the pumps. There was no danger in the bark sinking, for the cargo would keep her afloat. She would wallow, a waterlogged hulk, through the sea until her crew perished of starvation and thirst, or until they were washed overboard by the seas and swept over her every minute. And there was always a possibility of rescue, a hope that, no matter what the circumstances, never left the minds of the great seamen of the days of wooden ships. Such was the condition of the Countess of Dufferin on the 29th day of December, 1891. For reasons which will be plain later, I want you to remember that date, the 29th day of December. Now, while all this was taking place, the ship Arlington, under the command of Captain Samuel Bancroft Davis of Yarmouth, was on her way from the old country to New York. What was a disastrous wind for the Countess of Dufferin was a fair wind for the Arlington, for she was in a fair way to set a record for crossing the Atlantic, when on the 28th day of December, one of those inexplicable events that happen once in a lifetime occurred. In the middle of the night, during the second mate's watch, Captain Davis suddenly appeared on deck. "Luff!" he shouted. "Hail, O distress! Luff!" The helmsman spun the wheel hard up. The Arlington's head swung into the wind, and the second mate ran to Captain Davis' side. "Where's the hail from, sir?" he asked. "Didn't you hear it?" demanded the captain in astonishment. "No, sir," replied the second mate wonderingly. "Look out, ahoy!" he shouted. "Did you hear a hail of distress?" "No, sir," came the lookout's instant answer. This was a puzzler for the captain. He questioned every man of the watch, but none of them heard a hail of distress. He turned in perplexity to the second mate. "I can't understand this," he said. "I was below asleep when I heard a hail of distress as plain as could be." "Why, they even gave their position, 52 north, 21 west. The second mate gasped. "That's a day's sail to the north of us, sir," he exclaimed. "You must have been dreaming." But dream or no dream, the hail was so vivid to Captain Davis that he ordered the Arlington's course changed then and there to reach the spot of which he had heard in his dream. This took the Arlington 2 points off her course, far out of the one regular ship lanes, and to speak plainly, some of the crew began to doubt the captain's sanity. There were many stories current of skippers whose reason had fled them and who had gravely endangered the safety of their crew and ship to satisfy insane whims. The Arlington's crew feared that such a situation now faced them. No amount of persuasion, however, would induce Captain Davis to change his mind, and he was not a man with whom one could argue. Therefore, the Arlington sped northward, while the officers and crews watched their captain with anxious faces. The course had been changed early in the morning of the 28th of December. All that day, the Arlington kept on her way. The night passed, and the next day, without the least sign that Captain Davis had any ground whatever for his peculiar behavior. Then, on the night of the 29th of December, the date I asked you to remember, as the captain neared the position given in the captain's dream, additional lookouts were posted. And at midnight, Captain Davis himself came on board and took the watch. Nervously, he paced the deck for more than an hour. There seemed to be nothing around them but windy darkness. The Arlington plowed steadily through the water. Suddenly, there came a sharp cry from one of the lookouts. "Something on the lee bow," he shouted. "It's got no lights. I can't make it out." Instantly, Captain Davis leaped into action. "Luff," he shouted to the helmsman, then to the lookout. "Are we going to foul it?" "No, sir," cried the lookout. "We're clearing it. It's going by in the lee quarter." Now, for all that he was thoroughly convinced that his errand was one of mercy, Captain Davis was very much angered at any craft that would sail on a night like that without any lights, or on any other night for that matter. A vessel without lights is a first-class menace to navigation anywhere. Therefore, very wrathfully, Captain Davis seized his speaking trumpet, and he shouted as the Arlington went past the stranger. "What ship is that?" he called angrily. "Why haven't you your light up?" And through the darkness came the answer. "Bark, Countess of Dufferin, St. John to Londonderry. We're waterlogged. Haven't anything to put lights up with. Please stand by until morning and take us off." The astonishment on board the Arlington can better be imagined than described. Captain Davis, however, was not one little bit surprised. This was exactly what he had expected. He sprang to the rail and shouted in reply that the Arlington would stand by until morning. With daybreak, the task of transferring the Countess's crew to the Arlington began. It was a difficult task, for the seas were still running high and the gale had not abated. Two of the Arlington's boats were smashed to splinters before a third one managed to reach the water intact and to remain afloat. Here another Yarmouth name must be mentioned in her story, that of Hemion, the first mate of the Arlington. The task of rescue fell to him, and it is credit to Yarmouth's seamanship that the rescue was completed. By early afternoon, the Arlington was again on her way to New York. In concluding our tale, we should mention that on the 30th day of December, the day of the rescue, the Arlington's officers were able to take an observation and calculate her position. It was worked out as latitude 51 degrees 30 minutes north, longitude 21 degrees 20 minutes west, very close to the 52 north 21 west of Captain Davis's dream.